not yet been offered a job, at least not formally, and yet the manner in which the Colonel was speaking suggested that she had already been accepted. He asked her to be seated, and once again reiterated that very dreadful things would happen to her if she were to be caught by the Germans. This time he was rather more specific. "You will get needles up your toenails." Half of her wanted to treat the whole thing as a grand hoot, one to recount to her flatmates, Clodagh Allain, later that evening. Yet Colonel Chidson remained cold and unsmiling throughout the interview, which Joan took as a sign that he was in deadly earnest. She also knew that in the newspapers and on the wireless, the talk was of nothing but war. Just a few weeks earlier, on the 15th of March, Hitler had scored his latest coup by marching his stormtroopers into Bohemia and Moravia. In doing so, he completed his annexation of what had previously been Czechoslovakia. The German soldiers met so little resistance that a jubilant Hitler was able to travel to Prague on the following day and proclaim a new addition to the Third Reich. Henceforth, Bohemia and Moravia were to be a German protectorate, firmly under the rule of Berlin. Although Britain's Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, insisted that Hitler's annexation was not an act of aggression, there were many in the country who felt that his policy of appeasement had passed its sell-by date. Joan was among those who felt a deep sense of unease, worried that Britain was being dragged into a conflict for which it was woefully ill-prepared. But when she weighed up everything that she'd been told by Colonel Chidson, the prospect of full-time employment and a generous salary overrode all her fears about the future. Besides, she was young, unattached and fancy-free, and a strange job in a strange office might just add to the gaiety of life. She convinced herself that it was all good, clean fun, and thanked the Colonel for what she assumed to be the offer of employment. She promised to show up for work punctually on the following morning. Although she would have never admitted it to Colonel Chidson, she was rather excited to be joining an office in which fact and fiction played so smoothly together. Yet she couldn't help but quicken her pace as she emerged from the building into Caxton Street, and she studiously avoided catching the eye of the mysterious man who was still standing on the street corner. Joan would have to wait another 24 hours before learning what her new occupation entailed. In the intervening time, she could do little more than ponder over the strange situation in which she found herself. She felt torn between happiness at having a job and a vague sense of unease at what that job might involve. It was as if someone were leading her into a bizarre twilight world in which all the cherished norms had been subverted. Joan Bright was not alone in finding her world turned upside down in the spring of 1939. 60 miles to the north of London, in Bedford, a caravan enthusiast named Cecil Clark was tinkering in the workshop behind his house at 171 Tavistock Street when his wife summoned him to the telephone. There was someone who wanted to speak to him. Clark took the receiver and found himself having a conversation that was as strange as it was unexpected. The person at the other end was not calling about caravans, that much was clear. Nor was he inquiring about the new anti-rolling suspension system that Clark had recently invented. Clark tried to probe the caller for more information, but the man declined to reveal why he was calling, and was, by his own admission, very guarded when Cecil asked as to his identity. All he would say was that the two of them had met a couple of years earlier, and that he would be paying a visit to Tavistock Street on the following day. Cecil Clark hung up the phone, still puzzling over the caller's identity and utterly perplexed as to what he might want. But, in common with Joan Bright, he had a vague sense that his life was about to take an altogether more exciting twist. In that, he was correct. The visit on the following day was to change his life. Chapter 1. The Third Man. Cecil Clark viewed his caravan with the sort of affection that most men reserve for their wives. He polished it, tinkered with it, and buffed up its cream paintwork with generous quantities of Richfield auto wax. More than 14 feet in height, it stood taller than a London double-decker, and its low-slung chassis was a revolutionary piece of engineering.